Resolution 24-264, moved by Councilor Hassman, second by Councilor Ryan. Be it resolved, the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar does hereby reconvene into regular open session of Council at
6:32
p.m. Call the question. All those in favor? None opposed? Carried. Resolution 24-265, moved by Councilor Zulak, second by Councilor Kekkonen. Be resolved, the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar does hereby accept the reports, recommendations, and directions arising from the closed session held May the 7th, 2024. Call the question. All those in favor? None opposed? Carried. We're going to close and just do a quick roll call again.
Councilor Morley Haskell.
Councilor Nick Ryland.
Councilor Debbie Zula.
Councilor Mike Hakkinen.
Deputy Clerk Carly Britton.
Fire Chief Robert Morrison.
Mayor David Moore. Any declarations of pecuniary and or personal interest in the general nature thereof? Hearing none. In the spirit of reconciliation and cooperation, we wish to acknowledge that the land on which we gather is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and the Mississauga people. Its boundaries fall within the Robinson-Huron Treaty of 1850 and the Williams Treaty of 1923. We are grateful to live here, and we thank all the generations of people who have taken care of this land for thousands of years. Honor the suffering of Indigenous people and the love and wisdom they have carried for thousands of years. We pledge to work in community and harmony with each other and the environment we inhabit, and work towards truth and reconciliation. We'll start with delegations presentations. Georgian Bay helped me with this. Nindu Gami Biosphere Overview of the Area Natural Asset Management Planning Project. You have two mics, good, so we maybe can introduce yourselves.
Sure. Good evening, my name is Greg Mason. I'm the Director of Operations with Georgian Bay, and it's actually Mindo Gami Biosphere.
Mindo, okay.
It's a tough one, because it looks like dude, but...
Looks like dude, too.
Yeah, no, that's the challenges of being an English major. So. Thanks very much for having us here this evening. I'm going to pass most of the presentation over to my colleague Angela from our office, but I'm going to finish up with talking to some of the planning applications and the implications potentially of this tool that we're proposing. As most projects and initiatives that come out of Georgian Bay Minidogami, we are looking at this as a very collaborative type project where we're trying to create a tool that... Sorry,
that's just something I'll do.
All right. I'll just wait. We are trying to create a tool that can provide maximum benefit for the region, be it municipalities, First Nations, researchers, or other not-for-profits that can support decisions for natural assets, and that may be anything from ecological values to floodplain mapping to climate change and climate risk mapping or fire risk mapping, if you will. And by doing this as a collaborative, we feel that we can create something where it's sort of a common suite of tools and data that everybody can benefit from and share in kind of that building of that resource. And so we'll do this presentation, and we'll speak to much more on kind of how we're bringing this together, some of the structure behind it, and then I'll speak to some of the applications, and then we'll happily take questions after that.
Great. Thank you.
All right, you can go next slide. All right, so we'll start with the very basics. This might be a reminder for some, but so what are natural assets? Simply put, natural assets are the elements of nature that provide value and benefits to both humans and the environment. So examples can include different habitat types such as forests, riparian areas, wetlands, water bodies, and biodiversity in general. Unlike the enhanced and engineered assets that you also see in that diagram there, natural assets are not created or restored by humans. These assets deliver many important ecosystem services that are essential public services as well, all on their own. These include things like providing clean drinking water, improved air quality, flood mitigation, carbon storage, and all of these are important for ecological health, climate resilience, cultural significance, recreational opportunities, and economic benefits. Typically, only engineered assets are accounted for and managed. However, being able to accurately recognize and manage natural assets effectively is crucial for sustainable development and conservation. Next slide, please. Why is it important to manage natural assets? I have four main benefits here. For one, they provide municipalities with vital services equivalent to and or greater than those provided by the engineered assets. There's also the cost saving and risk reduction aspect of it too. By being able to accurately identify, assess, and manage natural assets, you can save on capital, operating costs, and reduce risk long term. And how is really because natural assets are best course of action against climate change risks because they're naturally resilient and adaptable. And finally, effective identification, monitoring, and maintenance now will ensure that natural assets can be accurately accounted for to provide those services long term. On the right there, you'll see the natural asset management planning wheel, I like to call it. It's the approach. It's both a strategic approach as well as an iterative process to sustainably manage and enhance these natural assets. Just going over that quickly, there's three main phases that you can see in the colors there. The assessment phase involves looking at the current state of the assets. So something an example of that would be like completing a natural asset inventory. We'll talk a little bit more about this in some of the other slides, but this is the stage at which our NAMP project, our Natural Asset Management Planning Project, is currently situated at right now. The planning phase utilizes the tools generated from the assess phase to best inform asset management policy strategies and or plans, which are municipally driven. And then the implementation phase, of course, involves actually implementing the asset management practices and measuring and reporting. Next slide, please. So that's why, that's natural asset management in a nutshell, but why is it important here in this region? Essentially, there's been a long prominent discussion point within the Biosphere team, as well as amongst partners, that more accurate habitat and land cover information is needed to better inform decision making. For example, at the 2022 Gunawayna-Meshkeki Conference with GMI Hemby Inlet Wind Fund, participants emphasized the need for improved tools that will be able to help us prioritize locations for recovering populations of species at risk. However, there are several shortcomings with the existing data sets that are currently used for these purposes. So some of these include outdated information, inherent biases towards specific objectives or audiences, restricted spatial coverage, lack of floodplain and eco-hydrology information, or insufficient spatial precision and accuracy. Our interest in pursuing an improved model for the Biosphere region and actually for the entire 5E7, Ecodistrict 5E7 region, was also spurred by a similar project that the District of Muskoka, District Municipality of Muskoka, conducted in 2022, and that was their natural capital inventory project. They used a mixture of remote sensing, artificial intelligence, and machine learning, as well as pairing that with field verification on the ground to provide more precise habitat and hydroecological mapping. And that was done to help better inform their planning and policy decisions. So in general, there has been a collective desire to enhance stewardship, planning, and management efforts for biodiversity and species at risk protection, as well as climate change adaptation. As Greg talked about a little bit, to address these challenges, we have been having discussions with a diverse range of partners, including First Nation communities, local municipal planners, researchers, as well as the West Prairie Sound Geography Network, and we're hoping to determine a way forward that meets collective needs under the natural asset management planning approach. Next slide. So this is our overall goal here in the blue. Our overall aim is to develop an open source mapping database that will help us to better understand natural assets and climate risks within the region. There's three main objectives to doing that, but essentially the main purpose of doing that is to establish a database that will lay a solid foundation to enable evidence-based decision-making for management and planning actions, research initiatives as well, and collaborative stewardship among partners. It's important to note that the aim of the project is not to establish a regional planning authority. Rather, it's to provide the tools that will be able to then help decision makers better account for natural assets and climate risks. So our specific objectives are there. Number one is to establish an inclusive governance structure that fosters collaboration and promotes knowledge sharing. Number two is to generate high-quality spatial data and tools, and we want those to, of course, be scientifically defensible, accurate, up-to-date, and end-user compatible. And number three is to mobilize knowledge shared through the creation of tools, strategies, and resources that ultimately conserve biodiversity and build climate resilience. Next slide. So we're planning to carry out this project over a 4-year timeline that will result in the creation of 3 main deliverables. Greg also mentioned them in the very beginning, but the first one being an actual asset inventory, as well as that will then provide the stage to then provide the actual flood risk and fire risk analyses. It's important to mention as well that 2 components are going to run alongside these, and that's to basically assist with the technical modeling aspects of the project to ensure that those tools are going to be able to be used by the decision makers themselves. So that's 2 planning and policy components. The first one, which we've already undergone with the help of municipalities, municipal planners, the initial policy and tools review. And then that will be followed up with a policy action and implementation report in phase 2. The last phase of the project is focused on integrating the models and mobilizing knowledge for practitioners and decision makers. So right now we're in the first stage of the project, which is project governance and scoping. And a lot of that work is determining the actual outputs that will be generated and working with the people who are eventually going to be using the tool to come up with those metrics. Next slide. So here's a snapshot of our current progress so far. We've held project initiation meeting with regional partners to begin to establish that governance structure and conduct project scoping. The next point there is we're currently partnered with academia, University of Waterloo, and McMaster University to begin doing a lot of that initial data compilation and gap analysis, as well as determining a framework for acquiring, hosting, and disseminating the data. So that it eventually can be open source and used by a variety of different parties. And then development of ground truthing tools is also something that we're currently working on in-house to essentially be able to create the tools that will allow us to, on the ground, verify that what we're seeing in modeling is actually occurring on the ground. And then the last one there, development of a land use policy and tools review. As I mentioned, that's something that we've already begun working on with municipalities to inventory the policies, the bylaws, and implementation tools related to natural assets and climate risks so that we can ensure that the tools that we're developing are aligning with the actual existing planning and policy tools that are in place and being able to better inform those. And with that, we'll pass it over to Greg.
Next slide, please. It's a lot of technical information coming at you that kind of provides a bit of a background on the first sort of 2 to 3 years of work that needs to go into this really kind of before we see outputs that you get to use. Why do we want to emphasize sort of that background on this? And the main reason is that because we want this tool to be of the best and most application for your needs and purposes. And to that end, then we actually want to be able to speak with municipal councils and First Nation councils and those that will be using the end product so that we can ensure that in the design phase and the data collection phase that we have all the pieces of information that are going to serve your needs down the road. So that background information that Ann just provided is really important and it'll serve in the request that we make down in a few slides. The Land Use Planning Policy and Tools Review, it's important to emphasize because it's a sensitive topic, something, and I just want to reiterate what Ann said, is that we're not looking at creating a regional planning authority in any stretch of the imagination, so I just want to make that abundantly clear. What we are looking at doing is creating a platform or a mechanism by which your planning staff or policies or consultants, whoever they might be able to sit down with other planners and pool their ideas on, I'm struggling with this, whether it's, identification of species at risk habitat as it relates to a planning application. How can we make that a more streamlined process for consultants or for our staff to review and get us meaningful reports? Well, if we integrate that need right now into the design process, well, then we can shape the mapping, we can shape how it's processed and shown to you as staff and or you as council and the consultants down the road so that it's best serving that need. So to that end, what we're doing right now, and we've already begun to do this, is to build on some planning policy reviews. And this is really just doing an inventory of where are we at in terms of natural heritage values, climate, climate risk policy, pardon me, and floodplain policies across the different municipalities that work most closely aligned with the biosphere region boundaries. And this is from the township of Georgian Bay, inland up to Whitestone, or through Whitestone, and then up to the French River area for the boundary of the biosphere. And bringing those policies in together, just so we have an inventory of who's doing what from a policy perspective, what regulations, so the zoning bylaw, apply to this, and then what are the implementation tools, whether it's site plan agreement, tree cutting bylaws, you name it. What's there on the landscape to help with these implementation of these tools? What's working and what isn't working? And begin to get at why isn't it working? And is this something that natural asset management planning tools can help with in terms of making it easier to implement down the road towards your interests? So that work is, again, as I said, it's happening right now. We're able to actually provide municipalities with some financial support for some of the staff time to be able to inform that policy review from funding that we've received. Next slide, please, Carol. It's important to note, so if you're familiar with West Bray Sound Geography Network, they're the normal culprits that will be speaking to you about mapping and data inventory. And so we're working closely with West Bray Sound Geography Network because at the end of the day, we suspect strongly that they're the ones that are going to be housing this data and making it available to the partners. So we need to ensure that they have the capacities to house that data and to be able to show it out and provide it to use as municipalities and the other partners. We do, and we are engaging with other not-for-profits, and we're engaging with academia, as Angela already mentioned. And all of those groups will have a say in the eventual outputs of this initiative. And we're just right now building up some of the building blocks. Many of you are familiar with the State of the Bay. There's a CNBP, Mumwayanjiakizwin, which is a species at risk project that we host and run as a partnership. And all of those have tables that can provide us with technical and also strategic direction for the project. Next slide, please. At this time, we are basically providing this project at no cost to municipalities. And we have funding applications out right now, looking to leverage into the full 4 years of the project. If you know, we're relatively successful at getting funds for projects, and our anticipation that will continue. And indeed, we've already been able to leverage like 350,000 in the last 6 months towards getting the baseline data inventory underway with the University of Waterloo and working with other partners just to get this project moving along. As that funding comes in becomes more firm, we'll spend more time in terms of that governance process, but we can commit to ensuring that we're doing a good job of engaging with you, listening to you, and finding ways for your staff to have input in the project if you wish. Down the road, there's many different funding opportunities. And in conversations with West Bray Sound Geography Network, we do need to look at sort of what the long-term implications for having this data set available to you is, and with West Bray Sound Geography Network, structure that conversation and find a way to make sure that it's a least financial burden to you. But what I can say is that this kind of level of information is making your job easier down the road and providing you with clear decisions and more informed decisions about those natural assets, so we see it as being an absolute benefit to your work down the road. Next one, slide, please. In terms of the applications, sometimes it's the hardest part, but as we look down the road, some of the applications where this becomes really obvious is the updated land cover mapping. So right now, we're reliant across the region on M&R mapping that is relatively out of date. More than relatively out of date, it's very out of date. And so when you take that information and you send it off to a consultant, some of the reasons that the ecological consultants take so much time and cost so much to developers is because that baseline information just isn't there of high enough quality to give them the confidence. So they end up spending more time in the field. So that updated land cover mapping can help you as planners, or you as municipalities and your planners, pardon me, ensure that you're applying the best information that you have and everybody's on a similar playing field. Floodplain mapping, I'm a kayaker and I paddle the Manitobbing River, and so there's an example, the Seguin River watershed, the Manitobbing, where with With some of the changes that we're seeing in snowpack, with some of the changes we're seeing in water, like rainfall in the springtime, we need to be attentive to the changes of that and how it's going to affect some of our watersheds when we're seeing development. So we want to be able to do a floodplain mapping risk assessment across the region that then says, all right, these are highlighted watersheds where we have the most concern, i.e. it may be because, you know, geographically they're more prone to flooding, or it's that they're more sensitive, i.e. there's more public assets either upstream or downstream within that watershed where we need to be attentive. And yeah, I know that Lake Manitowoc has had its issues with dam management, but that relates to, you know, a couple of weird winters that you had where it's like you have a weird February freeze up after a big melt that caused some challenges. So there's an example where this could be applied. The other one is the fire risk mapping is one that we see as being a benefit, which, I mean, last summer we know as being a summer across Canada where there was a higher amount of forest fires. What we have right now as tools at municipalities or in the region are relatively blunt tools to be able to assess fire risk. And so what we're hoping is that we can refine that for you based on forest cover that you actually have and data and imagery that we actually have, be able to refine that and provide better information to your fire departments to help with public education or even into planning and policy around development and guiding, you know, things like what kind of tree cover you would encourage, those kinds of things can come into that. So, next slide, please. So at this stage, what we are really looking for from council, and it doesn't have to be in the form of a resolution, but is passing along any concerns or questions that you have. I know this is a lot to digest right now, so we're happily, you can call me up and say, Greg, I didn't understand. I prefer to call Angela. But anyway, call us up and say, hey, can you walk us through that a little bit slower, because this isn't really enough time to do this justice. But also, it's sort of making sure that we have a sense of what your concerns and what your needs are as a municipality so that we can begin to build those needs into this tool early on. And the next one is support from you, really for staff time and or council time, but to help us get that kind of direction and feedback and input into the model. We're not asking for a lot. It's not like every week 5 hours of Carly's time. It's like four times. It's like maybe four times a year at a meeting come together. And our hopes are that as we get funding, that we can actually resource you more in terms of being able to come out and visit with you or spend time with you and better understand your needs as opposed to having to constantly ask your staff to come and visit. So it's trying to reduce the burden off, but again, really wanting to build this with your needs in mind. Next slide, please. So yeah, thank you very much. The last one I would note would just be the notion of Westbury Sound Geography Network's involvement, is that we are hoping to formalize the partnership as we look at future funding applications. It would be of absolute benefit to have them as a named partner at the table, and we are actively asking for that support from them. So thanks very much, and again, I realize we've got a little bit over 10 minutes, so thanks for giving us the permission to do that. It's a pretty involved conversation.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
You
may have a couple questions here just quickly.
Yeah.
We're in the process right now, and I don't know whether you're at this stage or not, but we're working on our official plan and our zoning bylaw.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we're always concerned about amendments to those particular plans.
Yeah.
Do you think this would really affect, I don't know, you haven't seen everybody's, all the townships, I'm sure, what they have, but you would be looking at those, I would assume.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we recognize that every municipality is on their own sort of journey and time frame for those updates, and it's one of the reasons that basically we would say, here's the most up-to-date information that we have, here's how it's verified and sort of academically verified and peer-reviewed so that you can be confident in the data sets that are coming to you so that it can be, when it suits your needs, be applied into your, I think if it's an official plan schedule or whatever mean. And again, we're providing the tool and helping to provide that tool as it fits into where it comes in officially into your documents. That's entirely up to you. I wish it was available to you right now. but yeah, so it's that time frame is completely up to you.
Cool. So Rob's got a question.
Yeah, actually, if you don't mind, I'm curious as to. I don't mean to ask too involved a question, but I'm curious as to what details you put into your fire risk model.
Oh,
is it historical and if something hasn't had a fire in so many years kind of thing, so it becomes higher? Or?
Yeah, you know what? So I'm a retired planner and project manager, director of operations. But what I can do is I can actually put you in touch with the folks that would do that.
Okay.
To get you some sense. And
yeah,
for sure, in terms of, we would love to be able to talk to you and sort of mine your brain in terms of what your needs are so that we can make sure that the model fits that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
great.
Thanks.
See, our official plan, when we're trying to update that, it has to be approved by the province. So I'm just wondering, is the province behind everything you're doing here? I mean, they change their ideas too regularly. So I just want to make sure that you're on board with what their most recent studies.
So we would be bringing the province on board in terms of the methodologies that are used and clearing those methodologies. And really, I mean, the natural assets. One of the things that so the provincial policy statements often will refer to natural heritage values as opposed to natural assets, and really they're comparable. We're using natural asset management planning because there's an actual set approach in terms of how you do that work. There's an ISO standard that you can follow for that work. And as well, it's a requirement that, it's not a requirement right now per se, but certainly there are municipalities in the south that are looking at natural assets because, you know, floodplain management down there is much more of a bigger concern, whereas here it's not as big a concern. So we're leaning into that language, but certainly it fills multiple needs, and for sure as it relates to the provincial requirements or requests for data, this is I would say this will absolutely meet or exceed their standards in terms of quality of data.
Excellent. It's really good to hear too that it's not for a regional planning document as such, because obviously, well, we often hear the word amalgamation, and even the word regional, it has a southern tone to it, as opposed to area-wide sort of thing.
Sure.
But,
we can onboard that language. I've got too many gray hairs already to think about creating a planning authority, quite frankly. So,
Any other questions from council? Anybody online have a question? Okay, great. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
There's a card. So we have resolution 24-266, moved by Councillor Ryland, second by Councillor Haskell. Be resolved that Council of the Corporation of the Township of Keller has hereby received a deputation from Greg Mason, President, and Angela Vander Eiken, is it?
Yes.
Okay, Landscape Conservation Programs Coordinator of the Georgian Bay Biosphere, providing an overview of the Area Natural Asset Management Planning Project. Call the question, all those in favor? On the polls, carried. Moved 21.5 up to just prior to adoption of the minutes. So we'll deal with that right now. We have a resolution. I'll read it just to put it on the table and then we'll discuss. We have resolution 24-267 moved by Councillor Kekkonen, second by Councillor Zulak. Be it resolved, the Council of the Corporation of the Township of Keller does hereby give bylaw number 2024-38, being a bylaw to prescribe times for setting fires and precautions / restrictions for burning, and to repeal bylaw 2019-24 as amended, first and second reading. Now, prior to voting on any of this, we have the fire chief here, and Rob, if you wish to speak. Just as a preface to all of this, the amendments that you had mentioned, I believe have been incorporated, but you'll correct me if I'm incorrect there. And also, most of 2019 is there except for the permit requirement. That seems to be the big change. And a few other additions are in there, looking at other townships and what they have in place. So we'd certainly like to hear your opinion since you're running the department.
Is this on? Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll do my best with this. I only had access to this document as of, I think I downloaded it Friday night. Saturday. So I do have a couple of questions, a couple concerns, and I guess we'll just go through them sort of one by one and so forth. So there's definitely whoever put the effort. effort into this. There's a great amount of effort that went into building this, so that's great. And I think it's a good foundation that you can build on. A couple of small things, just to start. The definition of chief fire official. I'm recommending that with the definition of chief fire official, that...
Sorry, what page are we on?
Page two,
I guess.
Yeah, two. Okay.
Chief fire official.
Okay, good.
Yeah. I'm recommending that we include either a positional or a blanket approval for designations underneath this, because it won't always be myself who has to go and enforce. It will be a bylaw officer, it will be a captain, it will be a deputy chief. And so instead of having to bring people individually towards council, maybe a positional declaration or a positional pre-designation by the fire chief and council of a deputy chief, captains, acting captains, and bylaw officer. You know what I mean? Included in the designated officials, sort of.
So you wouldn't have to do it on the run?
So we wouldn't have to do it, but I wouldn't have to come to you next month,
right,
and say, hey, I want to put my deputy on here, who's going to be a new deputy. I wouldn't have to come to you 2 months later saying, hey, we want to put the captains on here.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. Just a pre-designation sort of just saves the unnecessary visits, I guess.
Now, with these, I know Carly's taking notes here, but you have a suggested wording as well, so, or at some point you will?
I can provide Carly with an email tomorrow with my notes that I've written down.
Okay. Excellent.
Term it however she sees fit. Under the definition of fire hazard rating, I just was hoping to include the term RFZ, restricted fire zone, because it is a designation of fire danger.
Sorry, where's that, Rob? I know the
page
is numbered, but three.
Sorry, I should give you. It's in. I'm still in the definitions here, working my way through the definitions.
Okay.
So that'd be page 3, fire hazard rating.
Okay. Yes.
Open air and outdoor fires, and this is one of the places I think we obviously are going to need a little bit more discussion here. The definition of open air and outdoor fires re-includes, if you remember, we made an amendment in the last meeting, the exclusion of campfire and recreational fire, but it's still listed on this copy. So whether we leave it in there, as it is appropriate to have it as a designation as open air burning, or whether we remove it and define separately campfire and recreational fire in regards to the use of the permit.
So we do have campfire recreation fire as a definition already.
Yes, but it is included in open air fire, and
right,
when you go when you get down to general provisions, it still states that anybody to set or maintain an open air fire will require a permit. So that is still included in general provisions 3.1.
3.1?
Yeah.
I know we're jumping ahead here, but
that's okay. I can go to there first. So
that's on public lands, though, not township lands. There's a big difference there.
I apologize. I didn't recognize that the township was struck out there, but I would seek to add or designate after fire chief fire official.
Yeah, I think the only reason the campfire recreational is included because it is an open air outdoor fire.
It is.
But I know what you're saying.
Is that, yeah. I'm just trying to remove the ambiguity.
Yeah.
I'm trying to make this as easy to understand as possible. And there is still a fair amount of ambiguity within the document, but we're working in the right direction here for sure. 3.4.
Oh.
Sorry,
go ahead. We haven't got there yet.
Yeah. I mean, to go to Rob's point, I mean, from spending, I don't know, a better part of a couple hours today on reading this, I think right at the very beginning of definitions, we need to separate or list the number of fires that we would have and separately report campfire recreation fires, which mean... Of course they are open air fires. I'm not talking about that's common sense, but in terms of the definition, they're not. So we need to have those ones separated from other open air outdoors fires, which are listed later in the document, and also what's at the bottom of page 3, I think it is 3 anyhow, about the outdoor campfire device, which is essentially propane campfires, or propane fires, I guess be a better word. And there is others as I went through the document. In order to make this clear for a reader, especially somebody that's planning to have a fire and doesn't know whether they need a permit, it's very muddy, at least to me, to do this, so that if we separate them right at the outset and say these ones are open-air fires, meaning they are not campfires or recreation fires, and or the notable exception would be the campfire devices being the propane campfires.
Right, but just for clarification, they'll no longer be permit required for any fire, except unless it's on a special location permit on township or on public land, township-owned property. That's the gist of it. So for people to know or not know whether they need a permit, they don't need one.
Even to have what was described here earlier and struck out as a debris fire?
Right.
They don't need one.
Well, it's up to council to decide along with Rob's advice. We went through this recently with...
Yeah.
And I don't want to bring up the whole signage thing again,
yeah.
But I will. A number of people came forward and said people can regulate themselves. They know better. They're smart people. I mean, they're not going to go out and start doing things against the law necessarily. They might, out of ignorance, do something. But and so we had that feedback from those people saying that let people regulate themselves. Why have all these requirements? So that was the reason why that was changed.
Well, I don't know how many pages are here. I suspect it's about 10. I mean, for something that we're not regulating, we sure have an awful lot of words in this document.
Well, a lot of it refers to provincial regulations, too. So,
but again, it doesn't make it clear, to me at least, and I don't think it would to other people who are reading this. There's an awful lot of information here.
Could we not put no permit is required for...
At the beginning?
Yeah.
That might clarify, yeah.
Sure, I mean, I think the point is clarity, that's all.
Size is still in here, too, how big you can have the fire.
I have some issues with that, too, but we'll get there when we get there. So,
yeah.
Sorry, Rob, I interrupted you.
I think the most important part
of this document is the fact that we have an appropriate amount of discussion ahead of it, because there are a lot of intricacies involved in an open-air burning bylaw that, you know, in order to make it safe, but... understandable and usable at the same time, right?
Yeah.
What's in the best interest overall, right? So, 3.4. We have the inclusion, and I have not seen this in others. I'm just curious as to where did the reference to the Farming and Food Production Protection Act come from?
I think it was London, Ontario, but I'm not positive on that one.
Okay.
There was another that used the reference to it because of farming practices. And since we have many...
We have lots of farms.
Sort of farms around,
yeah.
And they're generally, I don't want to classify them all together, but maybe Debbie could speak to it. Rules really don't appeal to them.
Separate set of rules.
Don't appeal to them, but they do apply.
Well, some do.
No, some don't.
I get that. But so when I did my digging into this one here, and again, I didn't have much time to go through this, but I did do some sort of... digging just in order to understand it. Normal farming practice, as it's defined by the Normal Farm Practice Board, is a practice that is conducted in a manner consistent with proper and acceptable customs and standards as established and followed by similar agricultural operations under similar circumstances. It also makes use of innovative technology in a manner consistent with the proper advance of farm management practices. So, when I was digging through this and trying to understand A, where it came from, and B, what the ramifications of including this are, I came across three cases of precedence where somebody tried to use normal farming practice to do open-air burning, essentially whenever they want, because it was just what they'd always done. In all three cases that are listed on the normal farming practice board, I probably don't have the initials all correct. But I would ask council to maybe look up Brunton versus the Town of Gravenhurst, where the applicants sought a determination as to whether the burning of slash on their farm property is a normal farm practice for the purpose of non-application of the municipal bylaw prescribing times for setting fires and precautions for setting fires. The conclusion that they came to was that the safety concerns of potentially dangerous unregulated fires, as reflected in the Town of Gravenhurst Fire Control Bylaw, the FFPA, which is the Forest Fire Prevention Act, and the Outdoors Fire Regulation and the Ontario Fire Code, far outweigh the inconvenience which may be experienced by farmers having to comply with the provisions of a fire control bylaw. So in all three cases where a municipality had a burning bylaw in place and it went to the Normal Farm Practices Board, the farmer was unsuccessful because the practice of normal farm practice needs to also be best practice, essentially, is the way that they termed it. Just because it was always done this way, it doesn't mean that was the way it should have been done. So the decision that these people in Gravenhurst ended up getting was that the applicants were to conduct any burn in accordance with the provisions of the Ontario Fire Regulations, Ontario Regulation 207/96, as amended by the Town of Gravenhurst bylaw. If the proposed burn is not in accordance with the Ontario Fires Regulation and the Fire Burning Control bylaw, the applicants A, once each year before the first day of April, which is the beginning of fire season, file with the chief fire official an agricultural burn planning checklist in the form of what they've attached to Schedule A in the decision. Okay? They have to obtain annually, on or before the first day of April, approval of the agricultural burning plan checklist by the chief fire official. They have to receive telephone permission by the chief fire official on the morning of each proposed burn during the ensuing fire season, so between April and the end of October. And they have to conduct any burn in accordance with the terms of the agricultural burn planning checklist and any oral instructions from the chief fire official. During any such burn, the applicants have to permit reasonable entry onto their farm by the municipal officers or other officers as designated to ensure that the burn is in accordance with the Outdoor Fires Regulation and the Burn Control Bylaw. So they had to follow, essentially they had to apply for a permit every single time. So this was done with the understanding that just because, again, because it's always been done doesn't mean it's the correct way to do it. But also because if a fire was to get out of control on a farm property, it can very quickly leave the dimensions of that property and influence the properties around it, whether they be cottages, houses, other farms, and so forth. Fire burns rapidly. Fire can burn 40 kilometers an hour, depending on the wind, depending on the dryness, depending on the fuel load. So it's very easy for a fire, especially ones that are that big, to get out of control very quickly, especially when you're dealing with people who aren't maybe necessarily trained in the extinguishment, or proper extinguishment, effective extinguishment of the fire. The cost of that then is unfairly put on the shoulders of the other citizens of the township because they then have to pay for the fire department. They also have to pay, if it gets big enough, for the M&R to respond. And there's lots of bills out there that quickly reach 70 grand for an M&R to send the helicopter and a couple of crews in, and even a water bomber, to quickly extinguish a fire that's gotten out of control. One of the things that the M&R has said in their May 1st release was that they expect that for this summer, there will be probably a few RFZs put into place because we did not have the moisture load over the winter, the snow load, to penetrate down into the ground. And they're finding that some fires, especially out west, are reigniting spontaneously because they can actually live in the ground and smolder for long periods of time. Blew my mind when I heard about this, how long they can last. They've even gone so far as to start recommending exclusion zones around houses. So they're recommending people thin out the bush around your house. Zone 1, Zone 2, and Zone 3, they say you should have nothing burnable within 1.5 meters of your house. Up to 10 meters, you should have very little burnable or fire spreadable agriculture around your house. So they're really trying to push this exclusion zone as a matter of protecting properties and so forth. So I don't know whether now is the right time to be changing clearances and changing, allowing a farm property. And granted, if they've been doing it for their whole life, they probably know how to do it properly, and they're probably very good at it. But it only takes one to impact a community greatly. But I would just draw caution.
give you my opinion.
Yeah.
If we wanna still keep this in here, like this is not the hill I'm gonna die on. You know, I just think that this is an important thing to consider, given that we do have the three cases of precedence where it doesn't actually qualify as a normal burning or normal farm practice.
Yeah. No, it's excellent to hear that point of view. I guess the question I'll throw at you, and I'm sure you haven't done the research, in the 150-year history of the township, do we have any records of fires on farms that get out of control?
I know
I can't put you on the spot. I'm just saying, you're being proactive, yes, I see. And
I don't say that in my tenure, no.
Yeah, okay. And I know, too, we'll have people coming out of the woodwork, certainly, with the clearance around their places, because we've had just recently a situation they don't want trees cleared, and that's not the cottage environment sort of thing. So we're going to obviously be butting heads here, I think, with certain.
And again, this is recommendations,
yeah,
from an established agency that we rely on for this information.
Yeah.
But it, the term is recommendation,
right?
This is not an order.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's well within our power to do what we think is best for our constituents.
Yep.
So. So that would be my opinion on 3.4, is that I am in favor of striking it from the actual bylaw, but that I will leave that in the hands of council. 4.1, we start to talk about the reduction of clearances, safe clearances for open air fires. And in most cases, we've removed the 10 meters and install a 3-meter clearance. And I'm just curious as to the motivation behind this.
It exists in some bylaws, plus the fact that I think I mentioned to you last time, with 10 meters, you just eliminated, I don't have a percentage of properties that can't have a fire.
Generally, they are in the downtown core,
right?
The downtown area.
Right.
Where the houses are old and dry, and for the most part, some of the most susceptible structures that we have to an out-of-control fire.
I know, but they still want fire.
Oh, why?
So
I have no interest in making it so that nobody has fire. What I'm curious about is the size, because it still allows a 2-meter by 2-meter fire to be 3 meters away from the house. The amount of heat transfer that a 2-meter by 2-meter fire can create, if it is, in fact, 3 meters away from the house, it'll melt on vinyl siding. I would hate to see somebody come to us and say, well, you told me I can put it there. And
so
have
what
somebody
would you recommend,
try to get the liability out of us.
As opposed to the 10 meters, which we say is probably not fair to certain properties, what would you recommend?
Well, number one, I would suggest that we stick with the, I see that under 5.1A for campfires, we've increased the size from essentially 2 feet by 2 feet to 2 meters. Yet we only have a clearance of 1.5 meters. So our fire is now 25% bigger than the clearance that we have. Like, to me, this is a recipe for disaster. I would suggest that we limit our fires within the downtown area, and this is where some concessions can happen. And I want to just be open about that. I think that we can work with people to make everybody happy here. I think if we limit our size of our fires in the downtown core to 1 meter, and we insist on we can actually keep, for good practice, an 8 or 10 meter clearance. But then we offer people the opportunity to, let's say, call me, okay? And we create an acceptable clearance letter. We create an acceptable clearance permit or something. Where they can call me, they can apply in writing, let's say 2 weeks ahead of time, and they can have me come out to their house and they say, look, I don't have 10 meters because of the property line, you know? Realistically, though, on the other side of that property line is nothing but open property. So yeah, you might be within 10 meters of that property line, which now says that you can't have, according to the bylaw, a burn. But I walk out there and I'm like, okay, well, the nearest structure is 30 meters that way. Your house is 10 meters this way. Yes, you're too close to the property line, theoretically. But I see no reason why you can't have a safe and effective burn here. You know, I think that if we maybe alter the size a little bit, but also offer people the opportunity to say, have somebody like myself out, a designated official out, who's going to walk in and say, you know what, you can burn responsibly. Let me see what kind of methods of extinguishment you have. Great. Oh, your garden hose reaches all the way there? perfect. That's fantastic. And you have shovels or you got a backhoe in the garage, right? You have clearances that are necessary, but maybe they don't meet the spec of the bylaw the way that it's currently written. You know, I can say, sure, you can have that fire within, you know, 3 meters of the property line now. And I'm okay with that because you have the clearance on the other side of the property where you're away from the structure. Try to work with people to create a proper burn site and then essentially issue them a letter saying that they have permission to burn a 2 meter by 2 meter or whatever size fire we determine is appropriate for the downtown area at this designated site.
Just want to clarify that, so you'd be out once, would you be back to check if it's beyond, you're going to get a tape out to see? But my concern is, you're saying that now, yes, we don't always have the same people going out. It's like referees in hockey, not everybody calls the same thing. So my concern is, if you have somebody goes out there and is not so convivial as you are, and say that, no, you can't have it, this is what the bylaw says, there's no fire.
Yeah, but they have the documentation. They have documentation from the chief fire official or designate that says that they have, we can laminate a letter for them, you know, that says that as long as they burn at the approved burning site, so the burning pit, let's say, the approved burning location on their property, then we can forgive certain sections of the bylaw that are not necessarily achievable, reasonably achievable.
You can forgive.
Sure.
You see, that's the thing. Or you're not necessarily going to forgive. That's the question.
Well, it's, I bring back the NNR statement where they are predicting that this is going to be a
right.
worse year than before. And so do we really, yes, I do believe that people are smart and they can use common sense. But we also didn't have anybody call in 5 years to say, why do I need a permit for a campfire when the previous bylaw clearly stated they needed a permit for a campfire? So we're relying on people to do something that maybe they're not fully understanding or fully capable of achieving. So now we have the ability to go and actually have a consultation. Let's say I can walk up and I can say, sure, let's do this here. They have that comfort in knowing that it's been properly approved, right? They have that comfort in knowing that they've been told by somebody who has some knowledge in the subject that they're looking up the right sort of things and they're working with the right tools in terms of matters of extinguishment and that. And they're trying their best to be responsible citizens of the township of McKellar, you know, and they're not trying to put anybody else in danger and still trying to enjoy these things.
Yeah.
Right? It's again, these are suggestions.
So, somebody that like lives in the village and doesn't normally have a fire, a bonfire, or you know, a little fire, all of a sudden they have friends come up, you know, unexpectedly, and it's a beautiful day, and so they decide they want to go outside and you know, roast marshmallows and cook hot dogs.
Sure.
And that. So they never plan to call and have this permit ahead of time. Not a permit, but you know, a letter saying that they can do it. They just want to do it on the spur of the moment. So I don't see what's wrong with that.
Well, that's
like it's their place.
But you're referring to a campfire, though. You're not referring to a debris fire. You're not referring to down branches and stuff. You're referring to a campfire.
Right.
Which a campfire, like I had said, in the definition of campfire, we've increased the size of it exponentially, yet we haven't increased our distance away from a building. So in 5.1a. 5.1b, my suggestion is that we remove the two meters and go back to the 2 feet, or 1 meter, if we'd like to go metric, and we increase the minimum clearance to, at a minimum, larger than the size of the actual fire. So if we're limiting it to a 1 meter by 1 meter fire, then we increase the clearance to 2 meters, or we increase that campfire.
And there's no need to call you.
And there's no need to call me.
Okay.
And there's no, and we follow the original spirit that we were hoping to achieve with the bylaw 5 years ago of you don't need a permit for a campfire. You know, I see no reason why somebody living I don't see no reason why Mr. Moore can't have a campfire on his property. He can easily achieve 2 to 3 meters of clearance. He can have a 1 meter by 1 meter fire. Granted, we also have to understand that if we start trying to pile fires too close to structures by not allowing for certain amounts of clearance, there are some times when you put a dry you have to be careful about what you're, it, we have to provide a little bit of a buffer, is what I'm saying. I would like to see a little bit of a buffer, so a little bit more clearance, a little bit smaller size, and I don't see a reason why anybody can't have a campfire.
Well, that's the problem, I guess, definitely, of a campfire, because there are other types of fire where you try to,
yeah,
to burn some plants or weeds, because we're also, we're tied in here with the transfer station. And what we're running into there, too, a lot of people taking in leaves now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're having difficulty with, and also branches, to this. That's where they take them. And then the township has an enormous cost. I haven't got it all figured out here yet, but to move those, it's a transfer station. They can't stay there. They have to be moved. And so that's what we're saying. If individuals had the opportunity with some of those leaves, it's not a campfire as such, but why couldn't they burn some of the leaves at home?
As long as they can keep it within a 1 meter by 1 meter pit, I don't see why they can't. That's what I'm suggesting, is that we limit the size. I don't suggest that if somebody only has 3 meters of clearance or 4 meters of clearance between their house, that we allow them to have a 2 meter by 2 meter fire to just because they have branches down, right? Like, there has to be some form of regulation here in order to, you know, prevent.
Where does that 4 meter come from? The outer edge of the 2 meters?
It's arbitrary 4 meters. I'm saying 4 meters from the building.
I know, but I'm just saying, is it to the outer edge of where your fire is, the 2 meters, or is it the middle of the fire?
The 4 meters should be to the beginning of the fire.
Well, see, that's okay, that has to be clarified.
So that's a very good point. There's another point that we have. In my mind, I'm evaluating this as the beginning of the fire.
Right.
The beginning of anything that's, you know, incendiary. Right? That, to me, is what that means.
But if it reaches
clearance being the middle of the fire would only be, you know, 2.5 meters at that point in time, because that meter, that fire is half a meter thick.
Right, but if you took the 4 meters from the outer edge,
yeah,
then that gives more distance.
It does, yeah.
Okay.
It gives more safety.
Right.
Right. That's, so I wasn't coming here tonight hoping to, you know, solve all the issues and stuff like that. Again, I'm just trying to make suggestions. You know, that hopefully we can all work with, and we'll find a happy medium. Right. Sorry, yes.
I think it's good to have this discussion, and maybe those numbers came from Ontario Regulation 207-96, which indicates that the material is burned in a single pile that is less than 2 meters in diameter and less than 2 meters high. And the fire is at least 2 meters from any flammable materials.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, even the Ontario regulation maybe doesn't have the limits that are in more in a safer zone. But
that
I
is
that
the bare minimum, essentially, is what they're saying. That is what they want to see as the minimum clearances, is what they're hoping for. Yeah.
But I think one mitigating factor with the current bylaw and Ontario Regulation 207-96 is the times. So when you have a fire, you know, they have a different wording here in the Ontario Regulation. The fire is not started not earlier than 2 hours before sunset and extinguished not later than 2 hours after sunrise the following day or earlier, because those are the safest times to have a fire.
Yes.
You have dew on the ground, the
correct
ambient temperature drops,
less wind, humidity in the air, yes,
humidity, and so I think that is a major mitigating factor with when having the time, allowable times for having any fire during those time periods.
Yeah, I'm not going to lose any sleep if all of a sudden we can't allow, or if we decide not to allow any daytime burning, you know what I mean? Because to be honest with you, those numbers also happen to fit into when I have the most amount of responders available. It's not uncommon that during the day, during the week, on a Tuesday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm the only one sitting here. You know? And so for me to be responding to a big fire, that becomes an issue. Because McDougal's encountering the same issue. Whitestone's encountering the same issue. We don't have the number of responders during the day because we don't have the industry to support the employment during the day. Right? So the following those time rules are very attractive. Definitely makes things easier to handle. One of the things I would say is that, yes, that is the fire code standard for outdoor fires, and that is the bare minimum recommendation as it's been termed to me. I actually, I'm more than happy to email this to you. and know what they're talking about, right? And the, it is a bylaw, it's a guidance document for Canadian jurisdictions on open-air burning. So how do we create an effective open-air burning bylaw? And one of the things that they recommend, and yes, they talk about time of day and they talk about all kinds of different stuff, but one of the things that they highly recommend is... So key messages that they are saying that we should include in outreach and education, you know, avoid open air burning whenever possible, find alternative ways, all this kind of stuff, obtain a fire permit. They're really advocating for the use of fire permits and so forth.
Something to do with the fire department, I think.
Okay.
Sorry to interrupt. We have Orange Landing over here, and I just don't know whose vehicles are closest.
Sorry.
I think they might want to move them.
Mine.
Sorry. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
It's okay.
Thank you.
But Orange is the area I was, so... With the gravel in the parking lot, if you've got anything on that side of the parking lot, we'll push pause for a second and save you the paint job.
It's ironic this is happening while you're here speaking. That's all.
This is happening. I took my pager off to come in here and do this, so we didn't interrupt, but because I knew I had everybody training tonight.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Training?
Yeah.
No, it's not training. It's an
if your car is out there, you probably want to move it, sir. Thank you.
You keep way over there. So.
No. I constantly had my peripheral vision come in and go, like, really? So.
Yeah, sorry.
Somebody's
in
bad shape.
Right?
Mm.
So, that's good.
We don't have pickable. No, no, there's nothing like that.
So I'll just push pause for a minute, I guess.
Yeah.
Grab
me too. Oh, I don't know. Could be anywhere. I don't know.
Could be.
Yeah. Bring them here. Whoever's there.
All good? All safe?
You good?
Okay. It does kick up the gravel pretty good.
Yeah.
And that helicopter comes down, so.
Yeah. It's definitely ironic to have this happening at this moment in time, right? So.
I guess what we should do, too, in the sake of time, is have Rob put some of these things together rather than having to
yeah.
import them all.
Sure. This has only come to the table.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you can do first and second reading. If there are a lot of changes, then we can defer the whole thing. So, it's a matter of putting it out there. We're just suggesting, and we don't have all the councillors here, but rather than going, you know, you have, I'm sure, other places to be. Whether it could be in a report as such.
I'd be happy to provide a report, sure, of my suggestions for it. In fact, I'd be happy to include with the report the guidance document that the CCME.
I'd like to see that.
That they put out just for key things. But even in this document, for instance, they recommend a burning clearance of at least 15 meters or 50 feet away from any structure.
Whoa.
So, fire moves fast, okay? Even when you're dealing with a controlled environment like a kitchen where you don't have wind and you don't have the reintroduction of different fuels and stuff like that, you know, people, untrained people, are really only 70% successful with the use of fire extinguishers. You know, and that is like knocking it down. That's not even putting it out completely, permanently. So now you factor wind, panic, excess fuel, and all these other features into this, and it can move very fast. And it can be very scary, and it can be very costly.
Well,
both to the person and the township who has to pay for the recovery.
I'm not disagreeing, but even out on the highway, I don't know what the percentage of people who shouldn't be out on the highway even, but they are.
Oh.
And the same thing here.
Are you
going to stop everybody for 15 meters? I mean, most people wouldn't even be able to enjoy a fire.
I'm not saying that we
no,
have
I know
to follow it. I'm saying it's a recommendation.
Right.
I'm more than willing to try to work with people to find appropriate locations. I'm more than willing to try to work with council to find something that makes everybody happy. I would like nothing more than for everybody whose grandkids come up and they live in the middle of town to be able to sit out and roast hot dogs, you know, at night. To me, that's a basic right. Like, that's a basic part of enjoying why you live up here.
Yeah.
And I have no interest in that unless they shut down burning because it's too dry, and then it's incumbent upon me to enforce the ministry regulations. And it's incumbent upon us all. Respect it, right? So that we don't cause a bigger incident for the majority. So I will be happy to prepare a report, and I'd be happy to share the documents that I have that justify certain things. But again, whatever council thinks is best, you know, I just felt that it was important to show up tonight to say that there are certain parts of this that, that concern me and that I think deserve possible reevaluation.
Yeah, well, fair enough. What we tried to do is get something on the table because,
sure.
As you said yourself, 2019 was in effect and a lot of people didn't even know what the whole permit requirement. So we want to make this public, certainly what changes are coming. And
Yeah. Let's make it easy to understand.
Yeah.
Let's make it good for everybody. And I think we'll be a lot happier in the long run. It'll be more enforceable and we'll have a lot happier people.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay.
Any other quick questions?
That's going through the line behind you.
So council has to make the call on this, and Councilor Kekman referenced it. This is first and second reading, which in some places they just put a first reading on to get it on the table. The third reading is when the changes come, but then of course that's a bit of a shock to some people as well, because it's a completely new document. So council can make a decision to defer this, now that it's sort of on the table at least, until we get Rob's report. And the first, what worries me a little bit, I guess, you have two readings, and some say it's just a matter of, you know, the next step is third reading, and there's really not much of a change sometimes. So I'm thinking probably a deferral might be better until we get more Rob's comments.
I would like a deferral.
It did serve the purpose of getting Rob coming out
here
and telling us what he thought of it.
Yeah.
You know, I've always said, open lines of communication, call me anytime. Even if it's not in here and you have a question or you just want to know my opinion on something, please, I'm available. So call me whenever you have such a question. I will endeavor to have this, at least a report to you by, or do you want it in a draft of the bylaw? I can send you the email with all of the, like, the reports and stuff like that. I can send that to you tomorrow morning. This
one. Well, I think that the one thing, though, if it's going to be in the draft of a bylaw, it'll have to be redlined, first of all. And it's hard to redline a redline document. and also the fact that... the whole permit thing, because you got the general feel here, you're not from council that we don't want permits.
I understand that.
So
yes.
If you're redrafting, that has to be a consideration to keep.
Yeah. If it's council's wish to remove something like the daytime burning permit, which is I get requests for all the time, I'm not opposed to that. But then you know we have to, it'll be a significant campaign on behalf of the township and behalf of the fire department to let people know that there is. Absolutely no burning between, well, as it stands in the current bylaw 10 and 6. If we wanted to follow the ministry regulations exactly, it's going to be 2 hours after sunrise and 2 hours before sunset, there is no burning.
So when you look this over, and I'll look at it more closely as well, there's no clause in there that allows you to override what's in the bylaw?
Well, that's what the permit
at your discretion? I know the permit was.
The permit was my discretion saying, yes, you have the appropriate clearances and you have the appropriate safety measures and you have the appropriate knowledge to
right.
be able to handle the daytime burn, and the conditions, more importantly, are correct.
Yeah. And so how many, do you have a rough idea of the daytime burns people want, that don't want to burn between
this,
six
well, this
and
time
ten.
Of year, I get, I'm going to say, I can pull up the text messages because that's how I issue them, but I'm probably getting... 6 a week.
And what do you do with the daytime burns that don't come to you for permit? You don't patrol.
I don't patrol looking for them. But if they're called in, then we know this from previous discussions. I prefer education over enforcement.
Yeah.
If it's a blatant disregard, in other words, somebody doing something dangerous and there's like combustible liquids involved or something, or a tire fire, then of course I'm going to step in. But if it's, you know, it's just somebody who just didn't understand, it's like education over enforcement to me always wins. So we're going to have a conversation. I'll explain the bylaw to you, show you where you can find it, explain where you went wrong and what we can do to, you know, make this work. And if you can't see yourself burning in the evening and you have to do it during the day, then we just have to find the right day in which you can do it. And, you know, like, so there is a... A use to permits for sure, because it you know it does sort of encourage participation in the actual bylaw. Right? But again, I'm not opposed to no daytime burning because it's, to me, that's the most defensible time for me. Is if it's outside of those daytime hours, I have a much better.